Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press, focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host and sports writer for the LSJ. Joining me this week, as always, our LSJ sports columnist, Graham Couch, and Detroit Free Press, Michigan State beat writer, Chris Solari. Gentlemen, we've had quite a week since we last convened, and we will get into all of that football and basketball news here in a second. But first, our weekly check-in with how you guys are doing. Chris, how are you on this warmer Thursday afternoon?
I'm doing great. Just interrupted me bumping some tea grizzly.
Yeah, you decided to poke the bear, and all the youths on Twitter got mad at you. So that was quite an experience last week, I'm sure.
Yes, it certainly was. But you know, everybody makes their decisions.
As somebody who's poked the bear once in a while, I respect that element of it.
Graham, how are you tonight, or today, or this afternoon? Whatever, time is relative.
Nothing to complain about, you know. As we record this, got Miguel Cabrera trying to go for 3,000 in the background. Got a big Southampton Burnley game later today that I'll probably pay attention to. The English Premier League, life couldn't be worse, or couldn't be better.
I was just gonna say it's good to see you investing in a real sport like baseball.
And what I was going to say, you are one of only the few people in the world who has seen the entirety of the Magic Johnson documentary. So, and you teased that earlier this week in one of your columns.
I've watched the whole thing as well.
Oh, two people.
My story will drop Friday morning. So
it's a good doc. There's some things that could do better, but it's better than I think for people who like MSU and certainly people like Lansing or feel a connection to Magic, they'll enjoy most of it. And there's some revealing new stuff. I think it's one of those things, like if you're somebody who consumes a lot of what Magic has done, be it biographical or you know, the documentaries like The Announcement, the 30 for 30 films, The Announcement in 2012 or the 2017 Lakers-Celtics rivalry series, you know, some of it will be redundant. But, I've never seen anything that got into the relationship with Magic and Cookie as much as this. The stuff with his son is interesting. There's certainly more Lansing stuff than there's ever been, and some of that detail. I think there's a lot of really good, interesting stuff in there. And a couple things you wish they went into more, or a couple things, you know, I think that dragged a little bit. I thought the business stuff in the last one is one of those things a good editor would have condensed a little bit. But I also was at 2 in the morning watching my fourth straight episode, so I'm not sure if it dragged for that reason or if it dragged because it dragged.
I kind of give it to you on that because, you know, this is the difference between having a documentary that's self-produced in many ways, like Magic's and kind of like The Last Dance, versus an independent view. Now, I will say that the compare and contrast with the Winning Time, we mentioned the Winning Time show on HBO earlier, the last month or a month before when it dropped, you definitely see the differences between the fictionalization, dramatization version versus the actualization. And you're seeing it now with Jerry West and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar coming out with really strong messages to HBO about what they've done with it. It's entertainment, I will give that. But I thought the Magic documentary was very informative. I thought, to me, and I'm going to write a little bit about this, I was really interested from a differing standpoint, and I think a lot of our listeners would be, of just where the Magic and Isaiah disconnect was, because they had been such good friends, and I didn't realize how often Isaiah had come to Lansing with him, which I thought was fascinating, you know, how much time he spent around Lansing in the 80s with Magic and running camps and really around the MSU side of it. But it was the 87 series or 88 series, when Magic gave him a hard foul, during the finals that Isaiah said, and they started that fight on the court, that Isaiah said that's where our relationship really started to differ.
And I hadn't heard that. I think that was really interesting because I knew, you know, there was that interview with Magic and Isaiah that was really well done, that where they sort of came back together in recent years. And it does make you wonder about, like, Well, first of all, it does. There's a level of competitor, and I wish more athletes understood this. Like, the thing that made Isaiah and Magic friends, and the thing that made Bird and Magic respect each other, and Jordan, all these guys, is they would rip their mother's hearts out to beat you. And they would, as Magic says in that, you know, if it costs you a friendship to win, that's what happens. That's just the deal. And that is a level of competitor that not everybody is, but it's what it takes in a lot of ways to be, to reach their level of greatness. I agree with you on a couple, like I knew, so growing up here, my father took me to Eastern Fieldhouse in 80 something, right? To watch Isaiah, Bird. I mean, all these guys would come back and he would host these
games.
There
was footage of that in this too.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, those were big deal games. And that was more than once, I believe. I've tried to look it up in the LSU archives. There are a couple stories on it, like 86, 80, 85, 80. But there were also these pickup games that happened in the third floor over at Jenison, that happened at the downtown YMCA. If you walked, I remember walking in as a 10-year-old, riding my bike down to the downtown YMCA in Lansing, the old building, walking in on a pickup game in maybe 89. 90. It was when Andre Rison was a rookie with the Colts, because I remember his car was parked out front with a zillion Colts bumper stickers on the back. And the pickup game is like Magic, Isaiah, Andre Rison, Dr. Tucker, and I don't even know, William Bedford, I think, was playing in the game. Like, you know, you went over there, you're like, oh my, I mean, this is a, it's like an NBA game on the downtown noon pickup game courts, you know. So that is there's a lot of, I've always enjoyed the way Magic has, obviously I'm a Lansing snob, but has continued to, I mean, here's a guy, look at all these NBA guys who want to go to LA every summer. Magic was the guy that as soon as the season was over left LA for Lansing for a decade, and that I've always found interesting,
you know. And I think we talked about the disconnect maybe with that fourth episode of the Magic Doc with the business side of it. I think it was a missed opportunity to kind of focus some on the business angle, because one of the things when I was at MSU, and I think there were people in my general age range, you know, that were there in the early 90s to, you know, 2000s, you know, generally, that Magic would come back to MSU and play at Breslin Center. And I had a friend who somehow stumbled into a pickup game, and Magic would pick up basically four students and play against the MSU players and beat them. And then to me, you know, that's kind of how he does in the business world. You know, he's done that to pick up those around him and be kind of that leader. And I think they missed a little bit of an opportunity to show that there is a connect from his basketball side to the business world, but it was, I thought, well done. And it was definitely, there were some enlightening moments in it that are worth the watch. I mean, if you have Apple Plus or whatever it is that it's on, to kind of invest 4 hours in it and kind of get a better perspective.
I'm totally with you. I think, you know, you talk about the Michael Jordan one and these ones that are sort of, I mean, Magic didn't really produce this himself, but it's clear it's a pro Magic documentary, but
right,
it does.
Right.
It does do a good job, though, of, you know, just when you think, like, the business stuff, I think the reason that seemed a little long is, you know, not everything he's done has worked. And it just felt like there was this long.
They didn't shy away from it.
Yeah.
They also didn't shy away from it.
And yet they didn't shy away from other things as much. Like Jimmy Kimmel calling his TV show maybe the worst television show in the history of television.
Yeah.
Is a great line, and that's a little allowing the relationship with Cookie. And I mean, you do get a sense of just a decade of misery he put her through in a lot of ways, and being you know, willing to talk about that. There are elements to the documentary that aren't all, it's not spin. There's a lot of stuff that is, you know, I was happy that they included an interview with Paul Westhead right after they do the interview with Magic about the firing of him. And like those are important things that sort of give you credibility to get the other person's perspective. Right. And so there was some really good stuff there. I, you know, I left, one of the real things I left with was this sense of just how significant a person he is in so many spheres. You know, I mean, here's a guy who helped save the NBA. So just to basketball in general, he is significant to the health of the sport that exists. To Michigan State basketball, he is this enormous figure. To Lansing, he is the son of Lansing that's important. To the HIV/AIDS community, he is as important as anybody who's ever lived. To the, you know, and to black athletes and entrepreneurship, and incredibly, I don't know, trailblazing, but he certainly showed a little what can be done. And I thought there was an interesting line from Grant Hill about noticing a black man who was adored and revered and idolized by white people in Magic, and how that was interesting. And there's so many things that he, I mean, so many significant communities and people that he's touched that that's something that you're reminded of as you go through this.
And you know, from an MSU standpoint, and I know a lot of MSU people will kind of maybe bristle at this, but Joel Ferguson and Greg Eaton were featured in there in the business angle of it, of what they did in Lansing and brought, helped him as a kid understand that, that black ownership and entrepreneurship was a viable option. And Magic obviously took that to a much different level. And I think the Magic Johnson Theaters part was also what that did starting in LA when he opened those first theaters to the community, I thought was a pretty interesting thing, because sometimes you just think about Magic the basketball player as an MSU fan or as someone who follows MSU closely or has been around this area, but there's a much larger scope in that. Not, you know, kind of going to the cookie thing, I think the disconnect between what's the dramatization in Winning Time versus the reality of their relationship also to me was fascinating, because that the Winning Time documentary couldn't be farther off in making a fictionalized romance. And you know, you mentioned Doc Tucker too. I mean, they basically make some characterization of what Doc Tucker is in this.
Yeah, the Tucker thing's kind of weird. The Tucker thing is strange because they had known Tucker going way back, and you know, and I've known Tucker a long time. I don't know, pretend to know him as a person closely, and I know there's some issues with, you know, Glenn Robinson when he was his agent, and he's been sued by some people. I know there's some, not everything's hunky dory all the time, right? I get that, from what I do know, I do not think the sort of the representation of the character that's sort of representing Tucker, and they don't call I'll say this: it's interesting that the documentary does not, they call him Doc, but they don't call him Doc Tucker. So it's like they know they're creating a different character. If you're an MSU person or a Lansing person or a Magic person at all, it is worth seeing. And you can always do it like Apple TV and these things. You can do, be it a month, or you can just do a trial subscription. There are some other good things on Apple TV, not to promote them, but if you do wind up getting it for a month, I can give you some other things that are worth seeing, including Ted Lasso and The Morning Show. So those are two good shows if you're looking for things to binge.
You can also watch Coda on there, which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture and won Best Picture. And I just watched The After Party, which is an 8-episode comedy series on there, and I enjoyed that quite as well, too. So a lot of recommendations on Apple Plus from the Spartan Speak squad. All right. Well, I look forward to the three of us getting some hastily written emails after talking about this Magic documentary for the first 16 minutes of the podcast. Anyway, we march forward, and I say we start with basketball news. We had a couple interesting tidbits this week with Julius Marble deciding he was going to transfer from Michigan State, and Joey Hauser announcing that he was going to stay at Michigan State. I kind of want to start with Julius Marble first, because that was certainly, at this point, probably the more shocking of the two, especially considering I think we thought Marble was slated to be a starter for the Spartans this year. Graham, what was your reaction to the Marble news? And do you think there's a chance Michigan State can get him back, or is this done and dusted?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised initially. I mean, obviously there are circumstances with him and his family that make it not surprising in hindsight, right? I mean, especially if he winds up somewhere much closer to his mom and sister, and his, you know, father passed a year and a half ago and all that. You know, but so that, yeah, it was, I was surprised by it. From a basketball standpoint and for Michigan State, I mean, it's not helpful, but I don't think it's a huge deal necessarily. I mean, I think they're likely to add a piece in the portal. But you know, he was not defensively was not somebody who, had become a real, you know, he wasn't a rim protector. He had some deficiencies there. He was a really good offensive player, frankly. And I think they have those pieces. And in some ways, if you're going into the portal, maybe it's easier without him to convince somebody to come in. My sense is from Izzo, my sense is from that while nobody wanted him to leave, this isn't like a devastating blow as it may seem to some people just because of their situation at center. But yeah, no, I was absolutely surprised because I do think he is a guy who does have would have a big role next year, obviously. And it's a reminder that people have other things going on in their lives and things that, you know, and the other thing is with the transfer portal and the one-time transfer rule and the extra COVID year, all those things in the mix, like if those things didn't exist, I'm not sure he goes because he has the opportunity to go somewhere else now and still have two more years and also play immediately. And so there are a lot of things that exist that if you want to be home or you want to be closer or there's, you know, there's still time to create something else for your career.
I think to me, the surprise isn't so much that he is looking to transfer and I would imagine get closer to home. His home's in Dallas. His dad died in the summer of 2020 unexpectedly, like right at the height of the pandemic. I think to me, what was surprising is the timing of it. I anticipated that being a possibility a year ago. Understanding and knowing how difficult a time that is for him and his family with his father's passing. And, you know, I thought maybe it would be a year ago when, you know, Kithier and Lawyer and Henry and all those people left the program. It seemed like that was going to be the timing. But I think Izzo kind of maybe dropped a little breadcrumb that I, you know, during the year that kind of maybe, you know, at least in hindsight, listening to some of the things now, you know, Marble has been on a civil engineering degree track, and that's something that he has been adamant about, and he is really, you know, focused on that. And, you know, I don't know where he's at in his academic progress with that. He is a serious student, is what Izzo said, in terms of going after, you know, the civil engineering component. And that requires a lot of time that, you know, most basketball players don't go for an engineering degree. So, you know, I don't know where he's at on that degree track. Maybe he ends up, maybe he's got enough credits to finish up at the end of the summer and get that degree before he does transfer. Which then would allow him to go for a master's program somewhere else closer to home. That may have been a factor as well. You know, I think it particularly right now with decisions that are being made, coming out of the pandemic, you know, that affected different guys different ways, Joey Hauser being one of them. You know, and I think that, you know, if you kind of look at those two situations, you know, Marble obviously got some family circumstances that were weighing on him and he was away from home. And Joey Hauser, you know, I think kind of fell out of love with the game during it. You know, being away from home really for the first time, being away from his brother in college. You know, you saw that in the 2021 season. I think towards the end of this season that Hauser really started to have fun with the game again. Maybe around January 1st when he hit that, you know, he hit that shot against, I think it was Minnesota that he had a big bucket in, that really kind of changed his enjoyment of the game. And, you know, I had heard some rumors that he, you know, a year ago had considered quitting basketball. I don't know how legitimate they are or if it was just in the moment, but you could tell that, you know, come the end of the regular season and into the Big Ten and NCAA tournaments that he was starting to kind of blossom a little bit more towards the player that Tom Izzo recruited from Marquette. And really in high school. So, you know, I that didn't surprise me either that he was deciding to come back for another year. So I think that, you know, you got to look at those two situations. And I think that, you know, it's less to me sometimes about the basketball than it is right now, at least in these instances. It's about the person, not necessarily the basketball. Now, a lot of decisions in the transfer portal are about basketball. But, you know, I think you got to kind of take each transfer case, you know, individually with what someone's dealing with.
I mean, Chris, you mentioned the Hauser, the rumor about Hauser considering quitting playing basketball. Is that anything Izzo Michigan State related and just having trouble adjusting to a different type of coaching or anything? Or is that, do you think that's unrelated?
I don't think that's necessarily related. I think a lot of it was during the pandemic and, you know, the oddness of being isolated and, you know, here you have this monster game against Wisconsin on Christmas Day and, you know, you're limited with spending time with your family to protect yourself and your team from getting COVID. You know, that to me was a turning point. You know, I know, and then, you know, you look at what happened after that and that I believe was the one time that in that season that fans were allowed at Michigan State until maybe right at the end when they played Michigan. So they were playing in front of nobody and they couldn't have their families there. And that weighs on different guys different ways. I think that was a big part of it. I think a lot of these kids right now that have been in college the last 2 years are going to have some reacclimation to what the norm is. And I think last year, the end of last season in particular, as the masks started to come off in arenas, as the fans started to gather in masse again, did I think that, you know, you started to see guys, and I think Hauser was one of them, that really started to get back to a little bit more of the normal. You know, we'll never know, I don't think, just how much the last 2 years affected guys. Tom Izzo has been open and frank about a lot of that. It is affecting kids differently. And, you know, I don't necessarily, you know, it's hard to kind of to look at things from the, you know, pre-pandemic general fan lens of, you know, this guy's at my school, so he's the greatest. This guy decided to leave my school or turned down my school's scholarship offer. So forget about them. I don't care about them. You know, you get a little humanity, I think. You know, you should take a little bit of the humanity view towards it, and understand that it wasn't necessarily normal, even compared to their peers. I mean, a lot of their peers were still at home, and these guys and girls that did compete were basically on campus a year ago by their lonesome. And so no in-person classes. And, you know, so there were a lot of dynamics, I think, that came into play. And, did the Izzo weigh a factor in that? I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, I thought that Izzo treated Joey Hauser very carefully, because I think he knew what he was going through.
Fair enough. Let me shift back to Marble here real quick. Graham, where do the Spartans go from here with their post depth?
Ideally, you bring somebody in who is has some experience, some grit, good rebounder. Whether they're a rim protector or not, they're a natural defender. Somebody has some toughness to them. I don't think offensively you need it. You need a ton out of that spot, but you want somebody who's who gives you some options there. Because I do think, you know, I mean, I think Izzo likes this team more than a lot of fans do right now. And, you know, I don't think, and I don't mean to, I'm not going to act like fans don't have reasons to be concerned with stuff. I think people don't know how to handle the portal yet. And that's just going to take time. Because I do think that this is the norm. Like, count on losing a player every year, at least one. And count on it not being somebody you necessarily expected to go. And that's just, it is what is now. Because I still think there are, you know, if Izzo will play his best guys, his best three guys, guards, you have a chance to put together a lineup with Hauser, Hall, Akins, Walker and Hogard, and I think Hogard has a chance to be special. That's interesting and difficult for people to defend, and, you know, I think there are opportunities to do some good lineups that way. It'll be interesting to see what if Sissoko can give them, how ready Jackson Kohler is defensively. But I think they need to add somebody. I just do, and I think it's probably easier to do now if you're an outside big man looking in, in some ways, because you know, you can argue that there was a hole before Marble left, but if I'm a guy who's going to transfer in and I'm looking at their situation, I'm not seeing the hole. I'm seeing a guy who can play 20, 25 minutes, and Marble is a seasoned guy. I'm seeing Hauser, who they use at the five. I'm seeing two other centers on the roster, and I'm saying, where is the sort of guaranteed playing time? And now there's an opportunity to be the starting big man if you were the right guy, or play an obvious role. So I think they'll probably add a piece, right? You know, as it looks right now, they're going to have 9 scholarship guys next year, which you know, I'd be surprised they don't add a couple. But it's not as simple as just adding a couple. You want to improve your roster and find guys in positions you need and figure out what the makeup of the team you want to have is. And I think for people who think Izzo subs too much, you know, maybe next year if the rotation is legitimately 8 dudes, you might love next year.
I think that, you know, the people that are, you know, basically pushing a roster reset, you know, and looking at Mel Tucker's program and saying, well, look what Mel Tucker did. Why isn't Izzo taking that perspective on the portal? You also have to realize Mel Tucker's got 85 scholarships to Izzo's 13. I think that's basketball's a lot different in that respect. And particularly when you are considered a blue blood type program, you know, how are you improving for guys that are entering in the portal? You know, are those guys legitimately better than the high school prospect you might have for 4 years? I mean, there's a lot of cost benefits that go along with that, but you know, you also, you know, I think there were some limitations this year by bankrolling 2 of those scholarships and not having those bodies. But every program in the country is looking for a powerful center that can do the things that Izzo is looking for as well. So there's a lot of components that I think go along with that, beyond just simply we need to add bodies. And I think Izzo is, like you said, navigating that and trying to learn what will be the best fit. I think you talked about it recently. Just, you know, you want to have those core group of guys as your culture and your program if you are going to add from the portal. And that would be from the high school ranks would be the core guys, you know, the Jaden Akins, the AJ Hogards, the Malik Halls that have been there 3 years and understand the demands of the program to help bring guys like Tyson Walker along, as they did this year. So, you know, it's going to be fascinating, I think, not just this year, but in the coming years to see how exactly that fits into Izzo's strategy, because he's been for years. And the thing that I always find funny, though, is people talking about Izzo isn't adapting to the portal and all this. Izzo complained about graduate transfers and went out and got Brandon Woods. He's adaptable. You know, he might have his views on things, but he's also, his biggest view is trying to improve his program.
And people should understand that Mel Tucker doesn't love the transfer portal. Now, he's not as vocal about it, and it's helped him early, and he's done what needs to be done. But if you give Mel Tucker over a beer or in a comedy, he's not somebody who loves the transfer portal. I would be stunned to find many coaches out there who do. You know, Izzo's just speaking his mind out, and I think that worries people. I also think he sees, I mean, the thing you have to remember about college basketball, and it's easy to look at a team at the end of the year, but most of college basketball is the teams that win is still player development year to year. I would, you know, you can look back at the Draymond Green senior year team and the first team I really covered for MSU, and they did not, that was not a team coming in that people expected anything of. Now you can look at the pieces on that team later and say, well, but they had this guy, and this guy. But this guy, this guy, and this guy weren't this guy, this guy, and this guy when they were coming into the season. They were nobodies, and it was going to be a problem, or they didn't have the seasoning, and they weren't expected to be very good. And I don't know that Izzo even thought they were going to be that good. The you know, what happens in development year to year, and like I think Izzo truly believes that what Hogard can be, that this will be Hogard's team, and what you, when you get good guard play, what that does, good point guard play, and how that can elevate everything around it, and what you're going to have in seasoned players, perhaps like Hogard, like Hall and Hauser, and you know, what Akins can become, and you know, I think there are a lot of things that MSU basketball has next year that a lot of programs don't and would love to have. Now, that said, at some point, I think even if you are able to create some matchups that are trouble for people with what you have, you're going to have to rebound and defend and create that to win some big games. And you need to make sure you physically have the dudes that can do that. And I think that's where you probably need to add to the roster.
Graham, I am setting the over-under at Matty Sissoko starts for next year at 5. Which way are you going?
I'm going under.
Yeah.
Because I think it's more likely that a guy like Jackson Kohler is ready and the guy they use in that role, if they're, you know, because they've done it before where a guy starts and he's not the main player. My guess is it's not Sissoko, even if they're, I would be very surprised if that happens unless he takes some leaps and bounds.
Yeah, that's the development component. You know, I mean, you know, a lot of people would have said that, you know, there's no way that AJ Hogard starts, you know, even into December, you know, after the season began. And then all of a sudden he emerged. So, you know, this will be, I believe, you know, as much as last summer was kind of a little bit return to normal, this will be the first summer of normalcy, I think, in a lot of ways in college basketball and for other college athletic programs. So you could, you know, there's a potential that he could make that developmental growth. Because remember, Izzo going into last season was really trumpeting this, what he saw in the development of Hogard. And a lot of people weren't necessarily believing him until they actually saw it on the court.
And I do think that Izzo is hoping right now that you know, he finally now gets the Hogard they thought they were getting, and that he's back. And I mean, he's sort of, he ended the season in a really good frame of mind. And it's not just the 29 point. He played some really good games down the stretch, not just the 29 points against Davidson. And I understand there's some talk about playing Hall at the small forward, and you may see that some of the bigger lineup, depending on who else they get. But you can create some matchups where if you're 4 and 5 can shoot, and Hall and Hauser, you know, you do some things to people, and it's really how you play mindset, you know, and I think a lot of people are still, you know, I don't think people are expecting Max Christie back, and I think that needs to be something that I think people are becoming more and more in tune with, and so that, you know, create some other questions about how you're going to play different people. And I do think if Christie had come back and taken the step that we all thought was needed to be that dude, that could have been a really, you know, with him and Hogard sort of taking the reins, could have been a really, really the beginning of a special season. I don't think they're going to get that component of it.
And I think with the immediate eligibility of transfers, I mean, you know, as you saw with Marble, I mean, we're midway through, almost towards the end of April, there'll be other guys going into the portal. I think with the draft in particular as well, there'll be guys who potentially withdraw their names from the draft and are looking for other opportunities as well in the college realm. So, you know, there's a lot of balancing acts and learning curves that go along with coaches who are looking out for players that can help them immediately. That, you know, you kind of, you know, what we're seeing right now in mid-April, you know, by mid-May or the end of May, could be a completely different landscape of who's available too.
So I want to piggyback something you just said, Chris. I think is really important. A couple things. One, there are a lot of guys out there who have declared for the draft and also entered the transfer portal, and so correct, sort of seeing what happens with them. The other thing, if I'm a coach, and this is going to become more and more of a savvy thing, I'm not letting it get out there that I'm looking at guys really, unless there's a guy I really want to target and an obvious need, until May 1st. Because the sort of the thing that's different this year than last year is, guys, May 1st is the deadline to enter the portal. So after May 1st, Izzo can go after whoever he wants, and his own guys can't get in the portal. And so that's an important thing. Like if you go get a wing right now, you jump in and you're like, you know what, I'm going to go get a wing who's got 2 years eligibility left. He's going to come in. Pierre Brooks might look and go, well, shoot, I'm jumping in the portal. I'm out of here. You know, and so you've got to play the timing game on that too, I think. And if you want to bring guys in without losing your own roster, it's going to be that stuff's going to be fascinating over time.
It's another chess match for coaches.
Totally, totally.
Well, let's stick with the transfer portal, but switch sports over to football, where since the conclusion of Saturday's spring game, the Michigan State football team has seen two players enter the transfer portal, and the first one was running back Donovan England, who was part of the 2020 class, and then cornerback Antoine Booth, who was part of Mel Tucker's first full recruiting class in 2021. I don't think we're too surprised about England, since part of a very, very crowded running back room. And I think England did play in all 12 games last year, primarily on special teams, and Booth was redshirted last year as a cornerback. Chris, what was your reaction to both of those moves to the portal?
Well, when you bring in two running backs via the transfer portal, there's going to be obviously some attrition, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's more attrition at that position.
I agree.
And kind of the same with the defensive backfield. I mean, you've seen Mel Tucker go after different kind of defensive backs, you know, longer cornerbacks, bigger cornerbacks that Antoine Booth just isn't. You know, and I think that Antoine Booth is smart enough that he saw that writing. And I think coaches really, especially now, have to be pretty forthright with guys, you know, going into or wanting to explore the portal. So neither of those situations surprised me. The Ben Van Sumeren situation withdrawing from the portal, I think, also doesn't surprise me, because I think you only really get one opportunity to get a free transfer in the portal if you don't have your undergraduate degree already. So, you know, if he wasn't going to be able to be a grad transfer, you know, there may be some roles on special teams, because he was playing on special teams last year. I'm curious to see how they use him, because they've obviously brought in a lot of linebackers. Could they flip him back to like that H-back spot that he was sort of playing at Michigan and maybe use him there? You know, that's something that I've kind of wondered a little bit of, seeing some of the injuries that were there during the spring. But, you know, Eaglin didn't participate in the final open practice, so it was kind of evident right there that he would be the first to go. And, you know, Jarek Broussard, the Colorado transfer, arrives after he finishes his degree at Colorado here in the coming weeks. So it'll be interesting to see in the, you know, before that deadline, if one more running back goes in. And also, I think at the quarterback spot, you know, is Michigan State going to go in with four scholarship quarterbacks, with obviously Peyton Thorne being the guy, but then Hamp Fay and Noah Kim and Caden Hauser. I mean, Hauser is the true freshman, so you'd likely not see him leave, but, you know, never say never, because Quinn Ewers is, you know, I mean, shows that it doesn't matter if a guy doesn't think that there's a chance for playing time, they may jump it right away, but they're pretty high on Hauser being potentially the quarterback of the future. But what does that mean for Noah Kim and Hamp Fay? What, who's really the guy that they feel is comfortable enough to be the number two next year? You know, so I think there's still going to be some more movement coming at a few positions.
Yeah, no, I think the quarterback situation will be interesting, as Chris alluded to there, because, you know, there is a history. And I think if I was a coach, and all this is going to be mind games and sort of recruiting your own players. So you may love Caden Hauser as potentially the future, or think he has a chance to be that. But you've also got to convince guys, you know, that like in Michigan State history, the heralded dude that people thought was going to be the guy has almost never been the guy. And it's almost always been the less heralded guy has won the job. And because your coaches don't decide who gets to be the quarterback, that's decided by the quarterbacks. And it's not decided by your pedigree. And I know there's a lot of love for Caden Hauser out there, and I think he may be absolutely legit. But he's not the first Elite 11 quarterback to show up at Michigan State. And and there have been a couple that haven't. You know, you think of Keith Nichol, you think of Andrew Maxwell. Those guys never became the dude. And
Joe Boyster.
What's that?
Joe Boyster. I mean, that was an injury situation, but, yeah, you know, another highly regarded quarterback that did not pan out.
They've had a number of, you know, you go back to Ryan Van Dyke, you know, like they've had a number of guys that were, you know, it just hasn't been the one who's won the gig and been the guy. And so it's such a different, it's such a step up. It's such a, and so do those guys, what I think will come down to is, do those guys think they have a chance to be the guy at some point? What's their own confidence in themselves? And, you know, and the other thing that's interesting too is, because you don't have to sit out anymore, I do wonder if quarterbacks feel less pressure to leave immediately. For example, if you know, in the old days, if you knew you're going to have to sit out, you might as well get on the horn and get into the program you want to, you're going to be at next, and work yourself into that and look at their roster situation. But now it's like, well, I can let it play out. Wherever I go, whenever I go, I can go immediately. And if you're Hamp Fay, if you're – I guess Hamp Fay doesn't qualify for this. But if you're Noah Kim, you still have the extra COVID year too. So you got time, you know. And so, you know, if you think you're – like if you're Noah Kim and you think you are the true backup this year if something were to happen, and there's not – you know, we don't know exactly what they do. But if you're Noah Kim and you think I'm a one play away from playing this year, and I think I'm pretty good and can show that I'm a player, I wouldn't leave now. I'd see what happens. And now if through the course of fall camp and practice and all of a sudden it becomes clear you're not the next in line, or in long-term plans that it's not going to be you, then maybe you move after the season and do so where you get a spring practice somewhere else or all that sort of thing. But I don't know that – it'll be very interesting to see what happens with all those guys. I don't know that you get four guys – there, but I also could see a scenario where all of them stick around to do the season and see where, and sort of see where they are.
Well, let's move on to the actual spring game that happened this past week. Wasn't really much of a game, more of an open practice, and you guys kind of got to see a lot of maybe the depth chart looks like and who might be playing where and who was injured and who wasn't injured. And man, that I remember, I think Chris was the one who tweeted out, like, the injury list for Michigan State was pretty hefty for the spring game. But Chris, were you able to kind of take anything away from what you saw in the spring game, maybe in terms of the depth chart or whatnot?
Yeah, I think it's, to me and probably the other people who cover the team, a lot more beneficial to see an open practice like we did this year and last year. And really last fall as well, when Mel Tucker had the open practice rather than meet the Spartans. I thought you just get to see how they work and you know, to borrow his phrase, you get to see the process. And I think that's, you know, not now from a fan standpoint, it's probably not nearly as viscerally exciting as it would be. But at the same point, I'm not necessarily sure what you really get, both from a production standpoint and from an information standpoint, of watching teams get split up in half and having offensive lines that are split that aren't going to play together, and how that affects the quarterback's play and the running backs in particular. And that said, there wasn't a whole heck of a lot of offensive line to split up, so you understand why they did what they did. So I think that's the first spot that you look at, because, listen, they had six healthy offensive linemen and had to convert two defensive tackles during the spring to add some depth. And, you know, they altered their practices considerably from what I've heard, because of that. And we kind of saw that play out. There were stretches where the offensive line weren't working with anybody, but taking a break, doing technical work, just by themselves with no defense in front of them. So it was already going to be a spring that was important for the offensive line development. I don't necessarily know how much that really helped. I think they've got a lot of work and a lot of makeup to do over the course of the summer going into preseason camp. You know, when you have guys like Matt Carrick and Jarrett Horst and Gino Vandermark that were out, that, you know, probably will be relied upon heavily come next season. You know, I think that was, to me, the one area that you kind of looked at and was like, you know, we learned nothing really. And I think, you know, even when they went live, I highly doubt that you'll see those combinations on the offensive line next season. Otherwise, I think Michigan State could be in some trouble. But that said, I think you saw some things from Amir Speed first and foremost, at the cornerback spot that I think will help the pass coverage. And some of the things that they did, I think Marquis Lowry quietly can become a major player. I thought he had a good second half of the year once his injuries kind of went away a little bit, and he had a healthy spring. Not having Ronald Williams, I think, in the spring kind of, or at least in the final practice, you know, you didn't get a good picture of it, but I thought the secondary looked decent, and Speed going against Jaden Reed was some of the most compelling stuff that we saw, on the field. Last Saturday. And then the linebacker spot, I think it was pretty clear and evident that Aaron Brule and Jacoby Windman, the two transfers, look the part and look to their advanced billing and look like they're going to be major, major, major contributors in that defense, which I also think will help the pass defense. And, you know, the decision to move Darius Snow into kind of like that hybrid, you know, you want to call it a star, if you want to call it a nickel, you want to call it a viper, you want to call it whatever buzzword they've called it, where he's playing more of a safety linebacker or, you know, a hybrid position that allows him to maximize his hitting ability and coverage. I think that's going to be another big key for that defense.
I took away a couple things. One, I think a couple positions that were well, their weaknesses or at least very thin a year ago are going to be potential strengths this year. I think corner and linebacker, where they're going to have the depth to be as good in November as they were in September, so to speak. I think, you know, just the fact they were able to hang in there corner with some guys out or limited in the spring sort of tells you that at corner. And I think you're going to see, you know, sort of a – I'm very curious at linebacker. I think, you know, you got the two transfers who are going to be part of things. You've got Cal Halliday. You know, where is Darius Snow fit? How often is he in that linebacker role? And I think that's going to be a really solid position for them. I'm with Chris on the offensive line. Like there's, you know, I get why MSU fans are excited about Mel Tucker, and I think what he's done deserves all the buzz. But it is interesting how they view Izzo and Tucker differently just because of their public tones towards the transfer portal. And even if they don't feel all that differently about it, although I do think Tucker just, it is what it is, and he's going to, you know, do his thing. But because if you were to take, if this was an Izzo coach team right now, and you said, boy, they got a lot of components to be really good, but you know what? They don't necessarily, there are some concerns that the offensive line could be a problem. And I don't know yet that they have somebody who can rush the passer and really get after it and be effective doing that. Maybe they will, but it's unproven at both spots. Those are two critical things in football. No different than having a center who can protect the rim or a wing, you know, can score. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think that the rosters are really all that different in terms of where they're missing something. And yet the perception is totally different.
Well, think, Mel Tucker. Mel Tucker did what Tom Izzo hasn't done and gone into the portal and get a center in the Brian Green kid from Washington State.
That's true.
That's obviously different. You know, I mean, there's going to be a lot more guys coming. You know, we saw that a year ago with guys coming in from the portal. Like, for example, Kenneth Walker was ahead of Harold Joyner in large part because of the talent, but also because he was enrolled in January and Joyner didn't get there until after spring ball ended. So, you know, you see some things that, you know, the guys that are going to come in, like Jarek Broussard and Brian Green, and if they get any more transfers, how quickly can they adapt and adopt the system and become fits to play right away? You know, I think we talked with, you know, a couple of the coaches. I think Scotty Hazleton was who talked about the difference that it was with guys who came in after spring ball last year, particularly in the secondary, that by the time they got to preseason camp, there had to be a lot of on-the-fly learning for guys like Lowry and Chester Kimbrough and the guys that weren't there in January and all the way through spring ball. So that's something to keep in mind if they do add more guys from the portal.
And, Graham, going back to your point about Tucker actually, you know, bringing people in already off the portal, he went and hired a rush specialist as a coach in that Brandon Jordan guy. So we'll see if that works any wonders in the offseason heading into the fall or not.
I think that was a good, I mean, look, I don't think there's, I don't think they're standing pat. I think they're making the moves to be as good as they can, as quickly as they can. And I think they've done, you know, you look at what they've done at running back. I mean, I think you're likely to have two transfers as the main dudes at running back with Broussard and Berger, right? And I think they kind of know that. Maybe Davion Prim is part of that, but I think their sort of thought process right now is it'll be those two. And I think they'll be solid. I think the offensive line, if it can be solid, the offense has a chance to be outstanding. I think they've got great strength and some good depth at receiver, both young, promising pieces, and obviously a front man and Jaden Reed. Obviously, you got a veteran quarterback. I think the tight end position is going to be improved and becomes a strength, which could be important depending on the offensive line. And running back will be good enough even without Kenneth Walker. And it's just about, can you protect? Can you get a push to the point that allows you to compete in those games where those, you know, where you're playing legitimate teams? And I think we'll know quickly. Not only do you have, sometimes you can read some of it when they, you know, I remember when Michigan State in like 2018 didn't get a push against Bowling Green in the first game, going, well, the offensive line is going to be an issue, right? You just kind of know if you're not going to get a push against Bowling Green, you got a problem. But also pretty early on, I think a decent Minnesota team comes to town, and Ohio State's early. They got the trip to Washington, obviously. There are going to be some teams that physically we're going to know pretty quick where they stand, and they're going to know where they stand.
And some of those positions, I think, were compromised with the injuries too. You know, you're missing three defensive ends. You know, we talked about the lack of a pass rush and concern about that. I mean, missing Tank Brown, Avery Dunn, and Michael Fletcher, I mean, those are three guys that could become – guys that come off the edge in those situations. You know, missing Malik Carr, I think, you know, was something to kind of, you know, it's not surprising considering he was playing basketball and maybe there was a little injury there that you want to protect him because it is spring ball and he's had a long year. So, you know, there's Montori Foster too. I mean, you can't really gauge that number three receiver spot without Montori Foster being in that competition with Keon Coleman and Jeremy Bernard. And then the addition of Antonio Gates Jr. come the summer as well. So it was, I think, a pretty good thumbnail sketch of what you're going to see come preseason camp in that first game against Western Michigan. But I also think that, you know, the colors have not been added to what the full picture is going to look like.
All right. Well, the biggest thing I learned from this podcast recording is that Max Christie may actually stay in the draft. So I thought that was a little interesting tidbit you dropped, Graham. Any final thoughts here before we sign off for this week?
Yeah, and that's just the sense I get from people who are, you know, around the situation, that's their sense that this is the. I think people. It's not that something couldn't change. He could absolutely be humbled to a point that he wants to come back, or something triggers something that says, I'm not ready for this, because frankly, he's not ready for the NBA. He might decide he wants to be a pro, and he might decide mentally he's ready for that. But I think the people around him see him as a pro and want him to be a pro, and that's sort of been his trajectory. And my sense is that he's not at MSU working out. He's in the Chicago area, and I just think that's sort of where this is headed. Not that something couldn't change, but I think his intent today is to be in the NBA draft.
Yeah, and I know he was out in California working out as well at one point. But, you know, you look at the mock drafts, and I saw one mock draft, I think it was CBS, that had a second-round pick for Marcus Bingham, and Max Christie nowhere to be found in the draft. So there's a lot of intel that will be gleaned by Christie and his people over the course of the next month or so as they work out and try and figure things out and get a real true grade as he does get some ears and voices from scouts. And I think the other thing, you know, kind of switching gears to football, is a week from now we're going to be talking about potentially where Kenneth Walker is in the draft and what Connor Hayward and Jalen Naylor maybe did to boost their stock and see if they become second or third day picks, probably third day picks, particularly for Hayward. And, you know, a guy like Kevin Jarvis as well, who left for the draft with eligibility remaining. And, you know, can he play himself into scouts' view and become a pick? Because a year ago, it was the first time that we really talked about Michigan State's draft streak ending. And it seems like a new streak starts next week at this time.
All right. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, at Chris Solari, at Phil_Friend, and at LSJ Green White. Thanks for listening.